busted.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to School Socks Podcast. Today is November 19th, and we begin a new series. We just devoted a considerable amount of time to a better understanding of the trivia method. The next question, as far as I'm concerned, how can we start using it to make our lives better? One idea that came to mind was, well, better communication. So I'm very, very pleased to be joined by Daryl Becker for the next several shows as we'll go through this process of merging the trivium with what we've been calling nonviolent communication and what people are now starting to call voluntary communication. So I think this is a worthwhile pursuit. I think there's a ton of valuable information in the coming shows. Now, that being said, the goal of this show, the goal of this project, is education. So I thought we could start today with a little juxtaposition. Some people are actually relying on these public schools for education. Have you heard about this? Have you heard about them? And we used to do a series called School News. I kind of abandoned it. Like, things are bad. We all know things are bad. I don't need to keep throwing these stories in your poor little faces, especially if there's no constructive action that we can take. If something bad happens, then there is a constructive action or a way that we can discuss it where learning opportunities exist, sure, we'll do it. But this just came across my desk 5 minutes ago, just as I was about to hit record and begin this podcast. I wanted to share this with you. Like I said, for the purpose of a juxtaposition, this is what's going on in North America's educational, that's the sound of air quotes, institutions. This actually happened in Canada. They have public schools too? You bet. The title of this article is called Mom Gives Kids Homemade Lunch. School Forces Them to Eat Ritz Crackers. A mom, this is from Gawker, which is not one of those fake news websites. It's not like the best news website, but there's this new preponderance of these entirely fake news websites that just give stories to people like me, like the stories that we kind of want to hear, like Pizza Place in New York refuses to serve Mayor Bloomberg. It's like, yeah, that would be neat if that happened, but it's not true. And then we post them on Facebook and embarrass ourselves. So here we go. Mom gives kids homemade lunch. School forces them to eat Ritz crackers. A mom who thought she was properly parenting by sending her two young kids to school with a homemade whole food lunch was shocked to find a penalty note from school officials informing her that the lunch of roast beef, potatoes, carrots, oranges, and milk she provided was unbalanced and therefore had to be supplemented with Ritz crackers. She was also fined $10. According to Weighty Matters, which I believe is another website that reported this story, the Manitoba government's Early Learning and Child Care Department blindly follows a policy which requires lunches to be balanced, according to Canada's Awful Food Guide. Unbalanced lunches are subject to supplementation and a fine of $5 per missing item per child. In Kristen Bartku's case, she neglected to include grains with Natalie and Logan's packed lunches, a dereliction that was corrected through the supplementation of Ritz crackers. According to the nutrition facts found on its homepage, a serving of Ritz crackers, whoops, that's a dangling participle. It's okay. It's all right. It's Gawker. 10 crackers is a serving, contains 6.5 grams of fat, of which nearly half is saturated. Well, okay, let's not turn this into a whole nutrition discussion. The point is that, you know, according to the information they have about nutrition, this is kind of silly that they'd be given Ritz crackers, but we know for other reasons that Ritz crackers, not a healthy food. To drive home the ridiculousness of this policy, Kristen tells Weighty Matters she could have sent the kids to daycare with, quote, microwave craft dinner. Microwave Kraft dinner, by the way, is macaroni and cheese, just if you've been out of college for a while. Microwave Kraft dinner and a hot dog, a package of fruit twists, a cheese string, and a juice box. And it would have met with approval by the MCCA. As a follow-up, Kristen notes that other parents falling short of Manitoba's policy has resulted in the creation of a hot lunch program, which she described is great. The end. Well, that was kind of anticlimactic. I'll throw this up on the SSP Facebook page if you want to take a look at it. There are some visuals, some pictures of the notes that mom was sent home. Well, the kids were sent home with, excuse me. The notes went to mom. And it explains the supplementation process and the fine. So that happened. Anyway, positive show today. A lot will be learned. And because we are introducing, you know, a whole new arena of study here, I wanted to do it in a slightly different way. We've done series before, but this first episode is a little different. Initially, we're going to talk about, you know, Daryl's purposes for wanting to present this information. But what will follow is the grammar of Daryl's process here of merging the trivium with nonviolent or voluntary communication. So this will provide you, and you'll hear me say this once we get started, with a really nice running start. So Daryl actually created a glossary for his whole essay. And we go through that first, the individual pieces, and in the subsequent shows, we'll put them together. At SchoolSucksProject.com, we actually have a nonviolent communication group. It's actually right at the top of the front page if you want to join it. If you have an account, go join. Daryl's put some visuals up in there. And that might be a nice place, aside from the comments for these episodes, to post your thoughts or your suggestions and get other eyes on that stuff. So that's it. More of these shows coming soon. Thank you so much for listening. Here we go. Oh, wait, one more story. Otherwise, what will happen next will make no sense. I just spent about 10 days in eastern New Hampshire, the area where I grew up with my family. And I wound up running into somebody that I hadn't seen in maybe like 4 years. So 4 years ago, it's 2009. I'm a young podcaster. I think I got everything figured out. I'm quite confrontational with statist-y types. And I remember there being a heated exchange about something. And I see this person again. They haven't seen me in all this time. And the discussion, there was some kind of political discussion that came up. And I tried to just sit back and practice some new strategies and be polite because I already felt like this person had captured an image of me from our previous hostile interaction. And I really, it wasn't like, you know, dominating my consciousness, but I really wanted to make an effort to correct that perception of me. But based on some of the interactions that I was having years ago, you know, I asked myself, what is the picture of me? Some people, ordinary folks, serving their kids Ritz crackers when the school tells them to. What would they think of somebody who presented so aggressively like that? And a song came to mind. All right, enjoy the show. Here we go.
I was walking through the city streets, and a man walks up to me and hands me the latest energy drink. Run faster, jump higher. Man, I'm not gonna let you poison me. I threw it on the ground. You must think I'm a joke. I ain't gonna be part of your system. Man, pump that garbage in another man's veins. Go to my favorite hot dog stand, and the dude says, you come here all the time, here's one for free. I said, man, what I look like, a charity case? I took it and threw it on the ground. I don't need your handouts. I'm an adult. Please, you can't buy me hot dog, man. The farmer's market with my so-called girlfriend. She hands me her cell phone, says it's my dad. Man, this ain't my dad. This is a cell phone. I threw it on the ground. What, you think I'm stupid? I'm not a part of your system.
Well, hello, everybody, and I am so pleased to have on the show today, at this point, an old friend of School Sucks, Daryl Becker.
Hi, Brett.
Hey, Daryl. Thank you so much for taking time to actually do a series with us.
That is so much my pleasure.
And I first became aware of your pursuit several months ago, and really what you're trying to do, and I'm going to let you elaborate on this, is using the skills of the trivium method in combination with developing better communication, nonviolent communication, what we're calling voluntary communication.
Yeah, that would be putting it in a nutshell. I saw how these two things were essentially two sides of the same coin, that is, attempts to understand how to produce more predictability in one's life and between individuals.
I like to do little origin stories, first of all. I like to know where people are coming from, or I like the audience to know. Who are you, Daryl, and how did you come to this realization that this was an important pursuit?
Yeah, I'm Daryl Becker. I live on the Big Island of Hawaii. I am a professor of Oriental medicine, which means that I teach acupuncturists the various Western and Eastern medical classes so that they could go through and get their license of acupuncture. I also have a license of acupuncture. That just means it's the permission slip of the state wherein one lives that gives you the ability to do what you already know how to do.
Right.
Basically. So essentially, that's my day job. That's how I make my bread and butter. But I'm kind of living a more paleo existence myself. So
just butter.
The butter's all right. So, you know, you get the idea. I did come upon your work a bunch of years ago when I was listening to Jan Ervin's Gnostic Media, which started to put a few things together. And through you, Brett, I did come upon Wes Bertrand's work on CompleteLiberty.com. And he introduced us, apparently, to the ideas of nonviolent communication. So I basically was starting to learn both of these ideas of the Trivium method and nonviolent communication concurrently whilst I was finishing up my master's degree and working to get my license of acupuncture. This was just something that I did for my own upliftment. I found that there was a lack of clear thinking in many different venues of my life, of various people's life. So I saw how these two ideas came together to produce clarity inside of one's own mind, as you could have basically balance with the trivium intellectually and balance empathetically and emotionally with nonviolent communication skills. So these were things I started working on for the past several years. I was seeing the applications of them, and I would continue to follow your work, Brett. I would follow the work of these other individuals who promote the Trivium method and certainly continue to study nonviolent communication.
Yeah, and you know, I mentioned this in my conversations with Gene. It's hard to have one without the other when we're talking about intellectual, I don't even want to say versus emotional balance, because the two are so intertwined in so many ways. And, you know, if you don't have the intellectual balance and awareness, like most things that I think show up as emotional or interpersonal problems are usually related to lacking some kind of knowledge or some kind of skill set or some kind of method for problem solving. And, you know, on the other side, it's very difficult to be successful in intellectual pursuits if your life is significantly out of balance emotionally, right? You can't produce your best work. You can't be optimally focused. And I know this, folks. I'll tell you from experience that it's very difficult to, be very successful in one without the other.
Right. It was pretty much became more and more clear to me that it was the two methods used together concurrently. And there was definitely an overlap. So as I was beginning to seriously study nonviolent communication, I already had the Trivium method. So that means I was organizing how I learned nonviolent communication by putting things into a grammar section. There's a general vocabulary, as there is for Oriental medicine. It has its own jargon, basically. Mm-hmm. So in nonviolent communication, some of that jargon includes the ideas of observations, so how things are happening, the feelings going on, the motivating factors, which are called needs by most people who use NVC or nonviolent communication, and then requests, which just basically means actions or the strategies that are happening in the tangible world. So this is all like jargon, basically, and I was starting to organize that as the grammar or the basis for how does this function. And we're going to eventually get like deep into the grammar of that. But I began to see that with certain people who were gifted with nonviolent communication to an extent, they might not be very aware of the Trivium method of putting things in an order of who, what, where, and when, then why, and then how. Mm-hmm. So it was the absence of having things in proper order. They would be often missing pieces of grammar, for example, like the four D's, which we'll get to eventually. There are many NVC people, they would basically be mentioning things that would be very much going into that realm of the four D's, but not saying them explicitly. And then in the same way, many people who study the trivium, I would be finding they would not be aware of the grammar of the actual feelings and the motivating factors that cause feelings in amidst the communicating individuals, especially within themselves. So there was like a missing piece of grammar. It was the fallacy of the neglected aspect, basically.
Right. Absolutely. So what I think is important for us to do first is provide people who might be somewhat unfamiliar with the terrain here, provide them a map and talk about what you see as the real purposes for this pursuit.
So the first purpose I was coming to realize for putting these methodologies together was so that all individuals would actually have an explicit, and I mean explainable to oneself and to others in a very simple and straightforward way, a method to find and gently remove sources of cognitive dissonance, the aspects of the conflicting thoughts within oneself. These are the emotional pre-programmed responses, what people would call triggers. And I use that as the label called the splinters in the mind, whether emotional or mental.
Yeah, and we've certainly directed plenty of focus towards that in the political realm or in the educational or school debate realm on my show. But this really applies, obviously, to personal life, to emotional life as well.
Right. And I would see I'm mentioning this right now because the largest problems that I see within all individuals and between all individuals are these splinters, these aspects which are known as cognitive dissonance, the neglected aspect, basically, these information going on about what's going on in the mind and what is motivating someone to either not be able to look at information or to not clearly be able to balance information altogether. So that was the first purpose, as I saw this as very, very important.
Absolutely. And that's eating up RAM too. You know, it's kind of going on in the background and taking away from processing power.
Right, right. So that was one thing that was just definitely a source of anxiety within people, and then obviously anxiety between people. Mm-hmm. The second purpose was to be able to know and understand other people's splinters at a distance. In other words, to be aware of what actually is motivating someone else and to be aware of what other people actually possess as their splinters or cognitive dissonance, and to therefore take steps to avoid putting pressure upon them. And that's why I use the metaphor of splinter. It's the type of thing that most people would have empathy or caring about. They would respect someone else who is injured with a splinter, and they would not purposefully reach out and touch and poke someone's splinter. They also wouldn't purposefully try to pull it out without someone else giving them permission. And so in this same way, I'm basically saying that I'm coming up with a methodology here where people could just be aware and not put undue pressure upon such obstacles of people's critical thinking and obstacles for people's emotional equilibrium. So this is just a way of making it easier to build bridges of empathy, metaphorically, between people.
Yeah, you know, another reason why I like splinter is it's also something that's seemingly minor enough that people will tolerate. You know, it is not a snake bite. So the splinter in the mind is something that most people, it's never really coming to the forefront enough for people to deal with it, or in many cases for people to even acknowledge it. And I think it's hard to be empathetic to what other people's splinters might be or cognitive dissonance might be if we are dealing with so many unacknowledged examples of our own.
Right. And that's why it was the first purpose is to understand one's own. And then the second would be to understand other people.
Indeed, right.
Right. And then the third purpose was to actually promoting enhanced empathetic connection and communication, meaning to find ways of creating more palpable bridges of respect and understanding. And in this way, they would be leading to more frequent collaboration. Like you and me, Brett, we're collaborating now. We're mm-hmm. actually creating a project here. We're going to do this in multiple stages. And this, of course, leads to increased creativity and innovation. That would be my third purpose. And so finally, the fourth one is pretty much like taking that enhanced creativity and innovation and focusing upon specific obstacles, often called problems, and seeing them as actual opportunities. These are situations that can be used where people have a lack in one way or another. Goods or services can be provided, a la creating a business, as well as various artistic productions can be created. There's many ways, whether in cross-promotion, in producing an actual livelihood for oneself and others, as well as the, you know, many other ways of creating connection between people. All of these obstacles can be seen as actual opportunities, basically. And that's the further aspect of creativity and connection and collaboration.
So before we go on, Daryl, let's just talk for a few minutes here about your procedure for developing this list of purposes.
I'm already trained in diagnostics. In terms of Oriental medicine, I had to be trained in Western medical diagnosis as well. Mm-hmm. This is just a procedure where you go through and you're gathering data. This is the input. And then from there, the input is used to create a picture of what are the generative situations, the causal vectors is what they're called in that type of science. So in this way, I'm looking at what are the causal vectors creating disharmony between people and within people especially.
Right.
How do I identify them? How do I remove them? And what is the purpose of removing them? Which is, of course, to create increased connection. And then greater than that, the increased connection enhances creativity and actual collaboration. And there I'm seeing the types of obstacles turning into opportunities. The whole legacy banking system being an obstacle to people moving money here and there around the world, etc. Then you have digital type commodities being moved, such as the Bitcoin, Litecoin, etc. All mm-hmm. these alternative methods. That's just one example. And I'm not even sure if the CIA created those things in the first place, but regardless, it does promote the idea of, okay, there's an obstacle. And there's an opportunity, like here, like now, would you like to have other ways of moving currency and commodity around?
Yes.
Here's one. Here's another one. Here's another one. Here's another one. It becomes plurality. And so the obstacle becomes an opportunity. Someone who can step up and say, I know how to solve this one. And so with more of us who are actually connected and we don't have that barrier because there's been some infighting or some type of disharmony between people who would otherwise benefit from being connected, then they can actually stop. And the people who can step up and have the capacity to do something could then actually promote an effective collaboration.
Excellent. That was a fantastic answer. I'm glad I asked that. It's just, all right, Daryl, as we move on here, and because we have the luxury of devoting an entire series to understanding this, I really want to take time to help people not just learn the terrain to be able to see the map, but also to give them a running start as we get more involved in what you've put together for us here. Let's start with the grammar, because you've introduced a lot of new language. And there's actually a pretty extensive glossary here that I wanted to go through first. And as we learn the language, the grammar of your process, I hope that, you know, looking back on this in the future, the things that we talk about in upcoming shows will make more sense to people.
Sounds great. You know what I thought, Brett? Maybe we can each introduce one item at a time, because we both have these definitions in front of us.
Sure.
And it's not absolutely necessary that we have to read them verbatim. We could just explain them out as well. Though I'm happy to, occasionally I'm going to read from what I've written also. But sometimes what I'm going to do is I'm going to say it in my own words. I wrote them out as part two in my essay, Practical Definitions. Mm-hmm. I wrote them out this way because when I was working with you and Lisa Arbacheski and Richard Grove, I was realizing that for making a part two Tragedy and Hope presentation, I needed greater clarity. So I needed to start with the grammar, that a lot of people that I spoke with, even if they were familiar with my work and I had spoken with them many, many times, they still did not have these words come to their tip of their lips and their tip of their tongue, rather, as quickly as I wished it to happen. They seem to struggle. They seem to have ambiguity. So I started off with putting them in alphabetical order, starting with numerically 100% responsibility.
Gosh, I hope people listening at home will grab a notebook or a capture device, and then they have, for future shows, they've got a list of terms here.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm hoping, Brett, that I'm going to have to say that a nicely edited version of this essay, we could have it posted at schoolsucksproject.com.
Absolutely.
I'm hoping to have it, obviously, then posted other places as well. And then, you know, in addition to your capture device, you could also copy and paste. So
indeed.
Yeah.
Good old copy and paste. Let's start with 100% responsibility.
This is the state wherein an individual chooses to be able to respond to all internal and external events. That's responsibility. Mm-hmm. This is the opposite of denial of responsibility, and this is not equivalent to obligation. So that's just to start with. It's an aspect of being free. It's where you actually say, I have the power right now to respond. External events are happening, and I'm making choices.
Okay. So that's, yeah, that was the word that came to mind for me, is that there is choice involved here.
Right. The next one, well, you know, the four Ds of disconnected communication. This is life-alienating communication. So we're going to get to that. It includes demands that are unrequested, diagnoses, deserve-oriented language, and denial of responsibility. I will definitely define each of those.
Okay. The abundance perspective. This is one of my favorites.
Oh, go for it, Brett. You can read or tell me your perspective on it.
Oh, sure. Well, I'll read and then we can discuss it a little bit. The perspective of the individual wherein there is an acknowledging of a wide variety of choices which can be applied within many venues and situations. This is an also and perspective and is the opposite of the scarcity perspective. The abundance perspective is large enough to contain the knowledge, understanding, and acceptance of other individuals' choice to use the scarcity perspective. It is hoped that there is an effective system of mutually known, understood, established, and functional boundaries to help produce greater mutual respect of all interacting individuals and their particular choices. I always associated the scarcity perspective, since I first heard that term, with win-lose.
Yeah, that's pretty much what it is, pretty right. much. It's an either-or. It's win-lose. By the way, it also includes lose-lose. So, you know, that's just one of the possibilities with the scarcity perspective. You can picture two people who are both dying on each other's swords. Who won? You know?
Yeah, or I guess we could even fit draw. Win, win, lose, 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 and draw.
Yeah.
Where
yeah.
it's like, well, you know, let's agree to disagree. You know, what do we really know anyway? You know, walk away frustrated with nothing accomplished.
When I mention the scarcity perspective, I'm going to define that one eventually as well. Or Brett will, because, you know, we're going to take turns. This next one is very important. Boundaries. Internally, these are the explicitly known and understood preferences and common choices of logical methodology and frequently employed strategies and actions. Externally, boundaries are explicitly and mutually known and understood manifestations of cause and effect, which serve to provide enhanced aspects of understanding and respect between individuals by virtue of people finding easier and more effective ways of preserving all respective individuals' volition and autonomy while helping to make the dance between individuals more graceful and mutually agreeable.
Excellent. The next one is the bridge of empathy. A metaphor for a connection of mutual knowledge and understanding of the feelings and needs or motivating factors of all communicating individuals, subjectively measurable by the virtue of apparent signs of caring and respect. And this one, I believe, is very, very crucial because we are, in a lot of our pursuits, in a lot of the efforts to communicate some pretty complex and often uncomfortable ideas to new people, even if they're people that we've cared about for a long time and we feel this is an important message, this is an important idea we need to share. We have a need for the people we care about to understand what we're all about. It's very, very difficult to move heavy equipment, across that ravine without this bridge.
Pretty much, yeah. And that is definitely a metaphor similar to the splinters in the mind. The bridge of empathy is the connection between all individuals because, so far as I can tell, none of us is part of the Borg collective. We're all completely individuals.
Sure.
Complete with our own feelings and the motivating factors, which we'll get to, causing those feelings. So, yeah, this next one is the contextual circle. This is the actual contextual events, the set and setting occurring during the process of a rhetorical triangle analysis of events, which means I'm going to have to describe the rhetorical triangle. The rhetorical triangle, this is an explicit use of the knowledge and understanding of all of the relevant factors, including internal and external applications of the observations, feelings, needs, and requests, and the four Ds of disconnected communication impacting the author of a message and the audience who receives the message. So surrounding the rhetorical triangle is the circle called context. That was what I just said, the contextual circle.
Okay, so can we give an example of how the rhetorical triangle would work in an actual situation?
Yeah, because it's happening right now. Okay. Right now, I'm the author. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming you are the audience that I know of, mm-hmm. and then I know some of the people who listen to School Sucks podcast, so I know some of my audience, actually. I know them personally. So I'm aware. I'm the author. I'm aware of what I am feeling right now. I'm aware of what I'm observing. The observations seem to correlate with feelings that I'm having. The feelings that I have correlate with the actual values and desires that I have, which are specifically to communicate these ideas clearly and simply in such a way as the listeners of your show, of whatever age they are able to comprehend them. And you are listening, so I know that you're part of the audience. This is partially tailored to you, so so I have a desire to have my message fit within the context of your show. I have some awareness of your feelings and what motivates you, although we're not on video right now, so your body language would give more things away, but that gives you a general idea of that's the rhetorical triangle analysis. It's happening in microseconds for me because I've trained with it a little bit, but you can do it in a slowed down fashion, being like, okay, I'm the author. What am I feeling? What's going on to motivate those feelings there? What am I valuing and desiring? Okay, here's my message. These are my words. This is my cadence. This is my volume level. I can imagine what that impact would be over there for Brett. I wonder what he's feeling. He sounds pretty pleased so far. Okay, I'm picking that up. He sounds like he's got a lot of editing work to do after this is all over. So I'm picking that up too. I'm going to try to make it march. I'll try to make it very fluid and articulate.
That was absolutely on the mark, sir.
Thank you. So I'm keeping all of these things in mind, right? That's part of the rhetorical triangle analysis. And then the context or the contextual circle is the situation. I'm over here, Big Island of Hawaii. It's a pretty freaking hot day in my house, by the way. You're over there, Connecticut. That's part of the context, the set. The setting, it's daytime over here. It is nighttime over there, right?
Mm-hmm.
The other aspects of, you know, where each of us is at in our particular lives.
So the next four in our glossary here are the four D's of disconnected communication. The first one being demands, commands that are given, and this usually involves the old carrot and stick. You'll either be rewarded or you do this or else. And both are ultimately when we especially for those of you who are familiar with the work of Alfie Cohen and his book, which we've mentioned several times on the show in the past, Punished by Rewards, carrots are their own form of stick.
Yes. A demand is an attempt in a way to deliver a request. It's just unfortunately a tragic attempt to deliver a request. The request has the opt out. It has the options that you could come up with other strategies.
Mm-hmm.
So the next D is the denial of responsibility. By the way, we're going alphabetically. And this is the abdication or giving up of an individual's ability to be able to respond to a given situation. This is usually represented as a cognitive, whether intellectual or emotional, disconnection within the individual. There are many occasions where this is an active or passive denial by an individual of evidence that shows a cause and effect relationship between the choices that an individual makes and the effects of those choices, such as, for example, Brett, you made me lose control and I just had to start speaking louder and faster. It's all your fault. So, you know, please get it together because you don't want me to lose control like that.
So it's funny that all the experience that we've had evaluating politics, it's like a theater of the worst characteristics of interpersonal communication.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Read this list, that's what made me think about it. It's like politics is the showcase for the challenges that we have.
Yeah. And when most people say the word politics, there's a lot of wobble for that word.
Absolutely. Sure. Yeah.
It's not in my glossary here, but definition wobble, the aspect wherein a certain term is utilized by a person and they're not really using that term in one way all the time. They're using it one way this time, and they're using another way that time. It's wobbling back and forth for them. And then the other person who's listening to them, it's wobbling inside their mind. So this is the problem with abstractions. I try to get more specific, and I'm finding that, you know, using these skills, we can actually be specific and then get something done. So, yeah, going on to the next one there. That's yours there.
Oh, deserve-oriented language. Sure. Deserve-oriented language is a similar refusal or abdication, similar to the denial of responsibility, of an individual being able to respond to a given situation, usually represented as a cognitive or emotional disconnection within an individual. Punishments and rewards are often referred to while using deserve-oriented language. You deserve this, or I deserve this, or we don't deserve this.
Right. Yeah. It's extrinsic motivating factors, basically. It's the problem with education that you identified a while ago. And of course, the opposite of that is intrinsic motivation, where you make your choices based upon what is actually going to be the cause and effect internally and externally, and you're going for the desired result. So deserve-oriented language, that of promoting a punishment or reward, that of seeking for some type of extrinsic motivating factor, this is one of the problems.
Mm. And all three of the first three of the four D's that we've covered, demands, denial of responsibility, and deserve-oriented language, are really like the warming up for the development of resentments.
Pretty much. They're what I call the perfect way to make a barrier on your bridge of empathy. If you'd like to create a brick wall that is suddenly right there, just do one of these four, and we'll come to the fourth one, which is diagnoses that are unrequested. So if I just started to diagnose you, Brett, and give you all types of labels and tell you what's wrong with you, You could imagine the wall that would happen between us. And likewise, I'm sure that, you know, it goes that way from you to me as well, with the exception of I know this stuff. So I know how to translate the diagnosis into what it is that you're after. So I don't have to take it personally. But many people don't know how to do that. So diagnoses, these are labels, adjectives, and comparisons, which are used as attempts to place an individual within a generalized evaluation. These are often forms of the hasty generalization fallacy. We can get into the informal logical fallacies, which I'm sure you're going to cover in depth again and again, and you already have a series about this, Brett, such as, for example, you're this kind of person, etc., you know, just giving someone a label.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this happens a lot when that disconnection is already present, because while a lot of heated conversations on a variety of different topics would call, if they were intended to be constructive conversations, they would call for a pause, where people would say, okay, well, I'm not understanding where this person is coming from. I'm not understanding the motivating factors. I don't know why I'm saying this, because I'm not even thinking about those things. I'm not even acknowledging that those things are going on inside another person. So this internal dialogue, as an example here, makes no sense, because these things aren't even occurring to me that I'm saying right now. So, okay, well, I have some predefined categories that I'm comfortable sorting people into, so I will pick one that I know how to win arguments with and that I know how to argue against, and you are a blank kind of person. And right. I will move on back to my needs.
Right. And so here's the problem right there with diagnoses that are unrequested. So when you go to my clinic and you made an appointment with me, you're asking for a diagnosis because you want an effective treatment plan that's attached to the diagnosis. Now, if someone came onto your show, Brett, and you just suddenly said, I got a diagnosis for you, and they're like, wait, I never wanted a diagnosis. Well, yeah, you see what your problem is? Your problem is you're a statist. Mm-hmm. You just have this desire for a monopoly, obligatory state of government that basically forces everyone to do certain things, and that's your problem. I don't have a treatment plan for you. So you can see automatically that it was not requested, and you have no effective treatment plan attached to the diagnosis. So giving someone an adjective or a label, no matter what the label is usually less effective than actually having someone actually request a diagnosis. For that matter, you should be probably trained in having an effective connection between diagnosis and treatment plan. And of course, most people, by the way, they don't want a treatment plan from you because they might not think you're a professional or that it's not an appropriate relationship between you.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's just a way of looking at it. You know, I started into this stuff medically, Brett, and I think it's still a place where I'm always going to stick to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So those are the 4 D's of disconnected communication. From there, in our alphabetical list, we move on to 18 wheelers of logic. A metaphor for all the evidence and logic that can be delivered across the metaphorical bridge of empathy that we already covered. This truck contains a manifest of all available grammatical and logical inventory, which is voluntarily driven from one individual to another. What is unloaded from the truck is also voluntary. Love that.
That's pretty important.
This was, yes, and for the most part, I've heard you say a couple of things that could have been right from the script that I was apparently using for all debates I had prior to 2010. But this is such a beautiful idea to think about this in contrast to trying to hurl, heavy bombs, bullet. What we see is ironclad, bulletproof evidence and information across, again, a ravine where there is no bridge of empathy to people who are not ready to receive it because no one's ready to receive, a bomb like that. They don't want it.
Yeah.
It wasn't requested.
Well, just to say, the idea of having an inventory of what's on your truck of logic and what's basically your grammar and logic that you're sending over there. Mm-hmm. And you might even be, essentially sending over some strategies and applications of action that would be in the rhetorical aspect of the trivium. So basically you're sending information over there. And as far as I can tell, information is never actually going to be likely in bomb. It's going to be just having an effect, and it can be used or not used, basically. It's kind of like words. There's basically an effect of it. Hopefully it is going to be used for a win-win scenario.
Absolutely. Yep.
So the empathetic lenses, this basically is referring to a method of focusing information and practical applications related to the internal and external empathetic knowledge and understanding. Voluntary communication, in other words, nonviolent communication or NVC, is an example of an empathetic lens. And for example, also unconditional positive regard, which was created by Carl Rogers.
And can we talk just for a minute about unconditional positive regard?
It's an application of essentially being incredibly present to the situation going on with one's client. It is something that is taught in many massage schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it just comes down to being there and supportive, no matter what actually is coming at you. It's similar to the nonviolent communication tactic, except for nonviolent communication would be a consistent observation internally and externally. So in this instance, I think it's very important to understand that it's very good to look through and see how is your lens functioning. I prefer the NVC lens to the unconditional positive regard lens because I prefer to have a working knowledge that is functional and quick and applicable, mm-hmm. rather than merely trying to forget that I actually have feelings and things that motivate them and fully paying attention to my client. To me, that is very unsettling because occasionally things that the client says are going to have an impact, basically, meaning it's a coincidence, but it's correlated. They say something, I notice that I have a feeling based upon things that are motivating me. But that's all my responsibility to silently, quickly note and take care of. I don't make a mention of it, if I possibly can. I mean, especially if they're paying me to be present for them. So I hope that's understandable.
Sure. It sounds like maybe a shorthand would be like a non-judgmental bedside manner where you are there but not participating to the extent that you would in NVC with the other person because the relationship is different.
Yeah, I would like to very much just focus right there on this. I very much am trying to promote the idea that I do want at all times for all people to pay attention to what's going on in them. Mm-hmm. But there are many situations where it's completely inappropriate or counterproductive to actually verbally mention what's going on inside of you. There's this opportunity to actually be an adult, that part where we actually do all this work inside silently. The child, a little one, is going to be someone who has to say it all out loud because they're seeking verification and they're seeking help in managing both their intellectual side and their emotional side. There's an opportunity, of course, sometimes when you're with an intimate partner that you get to share something deeply about what's going on emotionally and intellectually, and you're literally seeking their guidance and help, basically. But for most interactions, I'm looking for standing strong as an adult to take complete care of all of this silently.
Well said. To that, we should quickly add empathy for the purpose of crafting and following intellectual and empathetic lenses. The word refers to the knowledge and understanding as well as the practical applications of the knowledge and understanding of the relevant feelings and the motivating factors known to cause all relevant feelings within the individual and within all of the people communicating with a particular individual.
That's what the way I'm using the word empathy. It's actually knowledge and understanding and a practical applications of this knowledge and understanding of these factors that we're covering bit by bit and in alphabetical order right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the gist of the way I'm using the word empathy. I realize that's not the dictionary definition of empathy. I'm just basically trying to promote a way of thinking about empathy in a practical way because it's such a definition wobble word, generally speaking.
Absolutely, and misused all the time.
Right. So emotional equilibrium and intellectual equilibrium, these are essentially the feeling of intellectual and emotional harmony that seems to denote an adequate level of internal balance and harmony. This is very subjective. It's completely designated so by the individual. So right now, I'm feeling mostly these types of equilibrium because I have no serious pressure on me. I have no classes left to teach today. I've got no other things that really are pressing upon me. I can handle this. I can just go ahead and go through and do this. But if I didn't have equilibrium on something, if I had something pushing on me, this would be an area where I can see, okay, I have some more work to do in this. So we can see when we have enough equilibrium, and just to mention this, no one is going to have perfect flatline equilibrium. That's called death. Mm-hmm. You're going to consistently have constantly changing feelings that are going to be responding or corresponding, actually, with whatever desires and values and physiological needs are going on.
So emotional equilibrium and intellectual equilibrium, just to reiterate what I said earlier in the show, very difficult to achieve one without the other. But most importantly, there aren't metrics for measuring this. This is just an idea that's worth introducing. You would agree?
I agree. It's mostly just looking for something that is desired by most people that I can tell. They desire to basically not be riding a constant roller coaster from despair to euphoria. It would be great to have mostly, you know, you have moments of euphoria, you have moments of despair, but generally, by and large, during your day, emotionally, you have it, you know, little up, little down, little up, little down. And intellectually speaking, you have some quantities of thoughts and they have some quantity of organization, some level of organization, rather. And this means that sometimes you have a whole lot of ideas and a lot less organization. That's okay. And sometimes you could have an actual absence of information or ideas, some little debit there. And this happens too. But it's the idea that you seek to have equilibrium. You can see when people feel settled one way or another.
Absolutely. We actually devoted about 6 shows to the achievement of equilibrium through getting things done.
Precisely. That was essentially, as far as I can tell, you and Rich and Tony, you identified one of the primal vectors that cause disturbances of anxiety is having this mounting to-do list, all of these mounting tasks. When the hell am I going to schedule Daryl Becker on and get this stuff done? All of these things like that. And then, you know, you figure out, oh, here's how I'm going to do it. I'm using my capture device, etc. And then the anxiety goes down because the anxiety was just there to show you what it is that you would prefer to get done. Basically, it was there to show you that you have an actual value and desire for this type of accomplishment to be created, this type of communication, you know, to reach your audience with these types of messages in this type of fashion. It met those values and desires. And
you're going to have that. That's a really comforting way to think about anxiety.
Yeah, it's just there. Brett, I'm here to help. Yeah, it's kind of like that. Each of the feelings we have, Brett, as far as I can identify, every single one of them, in the same way as a skin rash, is there to help identify specific causal vectors that you can go ahead and take care of. The emotions are there to identify specific values and desires that you are actually having, and the type of feelings that you don't prefer to continue having are there to show you that you need more work in a certain area.
Absolutely. To use Rosenberg's language, which my audience, many in my audience might be somewhat familiar with, obviously Marshall Rosenberg and NBC, the expression or an expression or a manifestation of an unmet need. And if I was feeling anxious and stressed and got into an argument and punched an unfortunate man in the face, it becomes a tragic expression of an unmet need, you know, something to that extent.
Right. And by the way, that was a strategy, the punch.
Right.
The actual feeling was corresponding to the value and desire, right? So the anger in that instance, there was probably a value and desire for ease and efficiency, you know, some type of, they wanted to have smooth type of communication or something to that effect. So it comes down to being able to identify what's a tangible thing. That's your observations and that's actual actions, requests that we make and strategies that we might plan internally. And then the intangible, those are the emotions and the things that generate them. They have nothing to do with the tangible world. They are completely real, obviously, because I don't know anyone who doesn't have feelings, but they are not measurable. And that's the very important difference.
Great. The next one on the list is enemy imagery, the use of unrequested diagnoses to create an us versus them division between individuals or within an individual. Let's talk about that one for a second, Daryl, within an enemy imagery within an individual.
People do like to talk to themselves. Mm-hmm. I have been known to do this myself. But back before I learned these skills, I certainly was giving myself bad Daryl. You know, you're this kind of person. I gave myself labels, disorganized, unmotivated, unaccomplished for my age, for example. Mm-hmm. I had all of these types of things and I compared myself to others. And essentially it was like Daryl initiating self-punishment protocol number 37. It was, you know,
right.
It was about as functional as, and by the way, I got that from a Star Trek Voyager episode where this Borg character was telling another Borg character to initiate a self-punishment protocol. You know, which is, you know, kind of like what people are generally doing. And in all honesty, I think it was what I was actually taught to do for myself. I was not so much taught, but I emulated this behavior from the adults around me. And this is a procedure that I've learned is completely counterproductive. So within an individual, saying, you know, I am this person is, you know, it's against me. But it's very much, enemy imagery is very frequently, of course, used between individuals.
Yeah.
Can't talk to them because they're a statist. They don't understand the non-aggression principle. That's an us or them division, and this is a problem. Instead, they are an individual. They have what motivates them. That's the primary. And then, of course, they have emotions. That is secondary. This is important to know. I might speak to the primary. I rarely speak to the secondary, to their emotions, because I need to know that they actually are okay with that. But we'll get to that in the future. Fallacies is the next one. And in this case, I'm referring to the list of informal logical fallacies, which I am generally promoting to be used as warning flags to isolate potential inconsistencies in the processes of understanding and decision-making, or what I would call logic. So there's a standard list of 42 fallacies. Michael Lebeauzier wrote a nice PDF of them. There have been about 200 isolated informal logical fallacies, but I think understanding the general 42 or even 20 of them gives you a functional use of them.
Next on the list is feelings. Emotions within an individual, which are often correlated with the observations taken in by a person, as well as being correlated with the adequate or inadequate strategies that are designed to fulfill an individual's values, desires, and needs.
This is so, yeah. I would have to say emotions seem very straightforward to most people. Connecting the emotions to those other factors, that seems considerably more rare, wouldn't you say, Brett?
Yeah, and so feelings is a catch-all for a much more complex system, which is why I think that that definition is important here.
Right. So the next one is grammar. This is a trivium term, a substantial answering of the questions who, what, where, and when. This correlates roughly to knowledge or data. This is evidence that a video camera would take in. This is analogous to the computing concept of input, and it corresponds to observations and the requests or actions, which are tangible and measurable.
Related to that is the grammar scan, an internal method of flagging specific words due to concerns or observations. For example, first-person plural pronouns. Ooh, could trigger concerns as to perspectives that might be at odds with the respect of individual preference. For example, we are over in Iraq with our troops fighting for our freedom, fighting them to keep our way of life. The use of we are and them possibly being defined differently by each communicating individual. Abstract concepts such as the state or the common good or the people might also be flagged for gaining clarity as to the objective of using each abstraction. Etymology is used to help know and understand the history of various words, to see word usages through various temporal and spatial perspectives. Well said. Well written.
Thanks, Brett. This is good to expound upon just for a moment.
Sure.
Grammar scan. So I have it going right now. And yes, I did get to very much enjoy first from a brief study of Michael Parente, who was a political social scientist studying a variety of topics, but very much coming from, unfortunately, I would call a rather left-leaning perspective, meaning that he was locked into the left-right paradigm rather than seeing something more in the rather freedom and absence of freedom paradigm. He definitely perked up my ears long ago when I heard him expound upon we're over there with trying to get our oil, and he perked up saying essentially, oh, I got very excited. I'm going to look at my portfolio since I own all this oil, you know. And then he was obviously making mention sarcastically, saying obviously he didn't have a portfolio. He doesn't own the oil, so it's not we. And that was the application of this that I had about 12 years ago at this point. And then I saw your video, Pronoun Magic, which if you haven't watched Pronoun Magic, go to YouTube and enter that in. I highly advise it. This is important to just understand this silently. This is a silent thing to go on in your mind, to just basically flag these words when people are using them as a type of bringing people in a collective together. Also with abstractions, the people, our culture, etc. There's a lot of wobble in these definitions, and etymology is important as well, because just even the simple words like trivia used to mean some sets of years ago, apparently, according to my research on this word, trivia used to mean the base information or grammar, logic, and rhetoric that you would need to study to begin to achieve mastery in that subject. And that's what trivia originally meant. Trivial originally would be the same thing. It would be the base information that you'd need as you're going on your road toward mastery of this type of information. And now you can see that trivia now to people means out-of-sequence information that wins prizes on a quiz show or that you win a board game with, essentially. Mm. And that's the absolute opposite of useful.
Or unimportant, like the minor details, like, oh, that's trivial.
Exactly. Yes. Unimportant. Here you have the history or etymology. You're looking at the word through time and space, basically. So in more people are using trivium. Now they understand the root to trivia. Now they understand the importance of understanding who, what, where, when, why, and how as the basis for gaining mastery in that particular subject. So grammar is just the static trivium. Grammar scan is the active trivium. Just wanted to clarify that.
Absolutely. And I love your language here where you say these occurrences are to be flagged for the purpose of gaining clarity rather than to be interpreted as invitations to make somebody feel stupid. That's such a better way of saying it, Daryl. Well done.
Thanks. Yeah. If we wanted to make people feel stupid, well, yeah, first of all, they're already making themselves feel things based mm-hmm. upon what they need. So people can be tricked into thinking that someone else or something else made them feel something.
Right, right.
That's the abdication of responsibility thing. And yeah, it's true. These things, I know all of this could be used against people. All of this information, just like neuro-linguistic programming, I would say nonviolent communications, big bad brother from the dark side of the force. Mm. Those are useful tactics. In other words, people can be manipulated, unless, of course, you know all of this. Then it makes manipulation much more difficult.
Okay, so we talked about empathetic lenses. Let's talk briefly about intellectual lenses.
Intellectual lenses would be the method of focusing your information intellectually. And in this case, I'm describing it as the use of the trivium method of critical thinking. So, you know, at this point, I'm really hoping that you're not just listening to this show. You've listened to Brett and Gene O'Denning expound at length on the trivium method of critical thinking. I'm hoping that you went through the Logic Saves Lives series. I'm hoping that you basically have an idea of what it would be that would promote equilibrium or that type of balance in your thought process.
Indeed, clarity. The next two on our list are related. I will take the first one, the language of choice, the use of words to describe or to make understandable to oneself or to others, an enhanced perspective of abundant possibilities, choices, and internal and external evidence of respect and understanding. The trivium method of critical thinking used in conjunction with nonviolent communication allows for this language to be both understood and spoken. Examples of the language of choice are prefer to, or choose to, or decide to, something is individually preferable or less preferable, intrinsically generated respect of individual choices, as opposed to extrinsically generated respect that is created from fear of punishments or the desire for rewards, and the external and internal cause and effect known and used for decision-making purposes.
Okay, that was a lot of words. Do you want to break this one down for people, or I can help too?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I would say either in internal or external dialogue, you're not putting yourself or forcing yourself or another person into a corner, essentially.
Right. You're seeing options, basically.
Yeah.
So it's definitely from the abundance perspective, again, it's this and this, also this, also this. It's looking through an idea of deciding to rather than have to or must. That'll be the language of obligation coming up. I guess the next one will pretty much define the absolute opposite of this, basically. But essentially, the language of choice, the title, working title so far, the book that I'm working on, is the purpose of all of this. Essentially, it's trying to come up with a way to create more of this internal and interpersonal equilibrium across the board. I'm looking to remove the wobble words, or at least if we're going to use them, to have a one definition for them, just one idea if we're going to use a wobble word. And otherwise, you know, you might prefer to do what I would generally do, which is to not use those words. So the words rights, which I'm going to get to in a moment, I prefer to use preferences, such as something that's individually preferable or less preferable, and for someone's choices and volition to be respected rather than for them to have externally created rights. So perhaps I should just go right into the opposite of the language of choice.
Sure.
The language of obligation. The use of words to imply or explicitly state a message using the four Ds of disconnection, that's demands, unrequested diagnoses, deserve-oriented language, denial of responsibility, either toward oneself or toward another individual, for the known or unknown purpose of creating an extrinsic or externally motivated event or action, such as a threat or punishment or promise of rewards, for the purpose of resulting in a strategy, often creating perceived winners and losers. So some examples of the language of obligation: should, must, need to, ought to, what is right or moral, what is wrong or immoral, extrinsically created rights, either or, such as a debate, the scarcity perspective, a win-lose or lose-lose engineering, extrinsic motivations in general, such as punishments and rewards that are received or given, and all types of coercive situations. I would love to very much expound upon the ideas of right and wrong, moral and immoral, and rights, just to make this very much understood.
Sure.
I understand that things would be actually preferable and less preferable. And that's, I think, what people are meaning by right and wrong, or moral and immoral. And I understand that you might want to only deal with people who have the same ideas, individually speaking, of what is preferable or less preferable. In other words, especially on the big ones, in terms of respect of one's own volition or personal possessions, especially one's body. So when it comes down to it, moral and immoral are just very wobbly words to me compared to individually preferable and individually less preferable or absolutely not preferable. Extrinsically created rights, such as from an obligatory monopoly government, is, in my mind, a poor substitute for actual respect of individual choices and personal possessions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm basically trying to promote this idea of, please, let's get away from the word rights, maybe. I know that a lot of people are going to continue to use the word. I'm not anymore using the word rights. I think I have rights as much as I have respect, meaning I only have the respect that I can actually have some tangible measurement of. And I'm not going to have someone else force other people to respect my choices. They either respect my choices or they don't. And it comes down to that, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, there's obviously the term rights has, as you know, generated quite a bit of debate and confusion.
Right. And there's people who would look at positive rights versus negative rights, and negative rights being defining things apophatically or in the negative by what would be said, you know, must not be done. I think that the work of Mark Passio goes heavily in depth in the apophatic description of negative rights. And I think that there is some great value in the beginning understanding of these concepts. But in the end of it all, between people, there is just either enough respect between people or an inadequate amount of respect of each person's choice and volition and personal possessions.
So let me ask you this. How do you feel about a word like liberties for what are essentially negative rights?
Sounds kind of wobbly to me. Could be defined many different ways. Respecting someone else's choice, when I say that and when I see someone and I could ask them, are you going to respect their choice to go ahead and do that? It doesn't seem very wobbly. It seems like they would fully understand what I mean. Are you going to respect their liberties? That could seem a little wobbly to me. So I'm happy that people are using it. I'm not going to correct people's speech and language. I don't do that. Mm-hmm. I translate it internally in my mind and I make my own choice of words, but I don't try to promote other people to either only use the language of choice that I have defined and I'm definitely putting into a written format. No, I'm not trying to promote that idea. If you find value in using it, great, use it. If you find value in using the term liberties, fine. I would just say this. I think that there'd be a lot of people who would maybe not see the end result as clearly from the word liberties as respect. Basically.
Absolutely. I agree. And I think an important takeaway here is be on the lookout and even just for your own internal process of words that, as you say, wobble, right? Because that breaks down the potential clarity of what you're trying to communicate. And that leads to more problems. So the next word on our list is logic. And we've already covered grammar, the who, what, where, and when. This is answering the question of why, also known as non-contradictory identification, the removal or isolation of contradictory definitions or identifications. And this is known as understanding. This is analogous to the computing concept of processing. And just to call back to grammar, we said that was the equivalent of the computer concept of input. Logic includes, but is not limited to, the explicit use of the separate informal fallacies as well, which we've covered on my show.
Yep. And we just mentioned before under fallacies.
Absolutely.
Yep. So that's straightforward. Any questions on that one?
No. Segues nicely into the next one here, logic scan.
By logic scan, I mean an internal method of flagging statements that are potentially inconsistent with evidence, statements that seem to be embodiments of any of the informal logical fallacies, as well as noting any concerns or observations upon the evaluation methods of decision-making processes of each communicating individual. So using the logic scan on oneself, motives are laid bare, methods of using grammar, logic, and rhetoric become explicit. Using logic scan to view other individuals who are communicating with us, we can see the possibilities of their choice of logical decision-making processes for the purpose of communicating clearly with respect toward each individual's choice of logical process, basically. So that was, kind of clunkily written. But what I'm trying to say here is this. I'm using logic scan as a method not just of using the informal logical fallacies to take note of someone, but also to understand the decision-making process of someone else. So if I am using the Truvium method of critical thinking, and I am using that type of the use of informal logical fallacies, of answering why, of processing, I'm removing contradiction, so I have one word equals one definition. That's my method, and it's explicit. I know it. I explained it to myself, and I can explain it to others. With logic scan, I'm also identifying how does the other person that I'm talking to make their decisions. I'm trying to understand where they get their logic. The Bible's true because the Bible says it's true. Mm-hmm. Well, that's their methodology. I can see that this is part of their decision-making process. In this case, includes the use of circular reasoning and, of course, the appeal to authority. These are two informal fallacies that I identified in that statement. So to communicate and create a bridge with the person, a bridge of empathy, I need to understand how they make their decisions, which I may as well call their methodologies of logic, which, you know, if you were using a textbook definition, would be broken logic. But essentially, it's their decision-making process, whatever the word is for that. I'm looking to understand that because by understanding it, I can make sure to not upset that apple cart, as it were. You know, if it's really precarious because, you know, you have a bunch of fallacies going on, I want to create a connection, and I would like to see, you know, doing that. I need to understand how they make their decisions.
So moving on to needs, which is next, you have moved away from that term and use motivating factors. And the definition is the values, desires, and physiological needs which correlate to specific emotions being experienced by the individual. So can you just explain that choice to us, motivating factors instead of needs?
Yeah, when I hear people talking about needs, when I talk with some of my friends who use nonviolent communication in their methods of communicating with other people, I've certainly seen for myself, and I've had many people give me examples of how when they brought up the need word to other people, there was definition wobble with the word need. So if you ever looked at the list, which I'm hoping that, you know, people go to the Center for Nonviolent Communication or cnvc.org. Mm-hmm. If you go to that, you can go to look for the needs inventory. You will see this list of all of these nouns, essentially, that are abstract, such as connection and communication and autonomy and safety and security. These are some base actual values and desires, and some of them include physiological needs, you know, air, food, shelter, etc. So when other people hear the word need, they think only physiological need and anything that you happen to value, such as communicating or intimacy or having ease and efficiency, is not something you need. That's just something that you value and desire. And I say, yeah, you're right. That is just a value and desire. And there's only one time I can think of when you have no values and desires. I think that might be when you're asleep, mm-hmm. You know, when you're completely unconscious, or in certain heavily drugged out scenarios where all values and desires are temporarily removed. Essentially, values and desires are the major part of motivating factors, and needs would be another part as well. So need is a quick word. It's a one syllable. I can understand, you know, the use of it. When Marshall Rosenberg first started to create this methodology in 72, he used the term action-oriented wants. He changed that by 92 to needs, which is definitely less clunky, but there's so much wobble, meaning different people will define that differently. And that's why I've switched to motivating factor.
And the needs are part of an abbreviation that you use frequently, OFNR, which is observations, feelings, needs, and requests. And we are coming to that. We obviously have been talking about nonviolent communication, which is a method of using observations, feelings, needs, and requests, and the four Ds, which we have already covered, applied internally and externally for the purpose of creating these effective bridges of empathy. And as Daryl mentioned, it was designed by Marshall Rosenberg, a student of Carl Rogers, who we've already mentioned, in the early 70s. And the OFNR model was existent since at least 1992, as Daryl just mentioned. So of OF, N, and R, we've covered feelings and needs. Next on the list would be, alphabetically anyway, observations.
So this is, observations would be the observable and recordable data, such as grammar, as a video camera would take in. Of course, it does include the five senses, but for the most part, it's your visual and auditory information that's coming in. And that's what's meant by observations. There's no evaluation. There's no labels that are stuck upon anything. It's just the raw data that's coming in, usually through the eyes and ears.
The input.
The input. This is the grammar input.
All right. So then on the other end of that is requests or actions. These are the tangible actions, verbal requests, or potential plans made by an individual used for the purpose of achieving specific goals oriented to fulfill specific motivating factors such as values, desires, and needs.
Right. So an action or a request could be made to say, you know, Daryl, I'm getting some feedback. Can you take care of that? Mm-hmm. And that's a request. You know, essentially, you know, you observed that there was a feedback going on. obviously instantly it triggers a feeling going on like, whoa, better take care of that. Then, you know, essentially because that you have a value, you have a desire for a clear, excellent podcast to be crafted here and to make a little less work for your editing later on. Then you open your mouth and you make your request. Mm-hmm. Daryl, would you be willing to take care of that? And Daryl says, yeah, I want to take care of that. So that's an example of the requests aspect in terms of, obviously, requests are the opposite of a demand. A demand is a tragic attempt to make a request, basically.
So this is the output at the end of a process that has taken
right.
place.
Both observations and requests, those are on the tangible side, meaning we can get three-dimensional, measurable evidence to show these things. Unlike the feelings and motivating factors, we really don't have the technology right now to show those things. It can't point to a feeling or a motivating factor.
Mm. And how serendipitous this alphabetical order is sometimes, because the next term on our list is rhetoric, which is the output in the trivium process.
Precisely. Is that my turn or yours? I'm sorry.
You can take that one, I think.
Rhetoric. This answers how this is analogous to output in computer terms, and this includes the active literacies of writing and speaking. Rhetoric refers to the practical applications of grammar and logic, and this includes, but is not limited to, the use of the rhetorical triangle. This is also known as wisdom, as long as the applications of the rhetoric are practical and achieve a desired and or predicted result.
And related to that is the rhetorical triangle. This is the explicit use of the knowledge and understanding of all the relevant factors, including internal and external applications of observations, feelings, needs, and requests, and the four Ds of disconnected communication, impacting the author of a message and the audience who receives the message. Surrounding the rhetorical triangle is the circle called context, or as we've already defined, the contextual circle. So we've already covered the abundance perspective. The counter to that was the scarcity perspective. And just to review that, this is the perspective an individual takes wherein a limited number of options are considered to exist, also known as the either-or perspective. This is, as I said, the opposite of the abundance perspective, and individuals who use this method often deny the abundance perspective as having relevance or applicability to various circumstances. This might also correlate to the informal logical fallacy known as the false dichotomy.
We understand something of what we're trying to avoid, and we're also seeing something of what we're often dealing with when we're speaking to other individuals.
Right, indeed. This
and
is
this
the box, the box, which I like to use. Not in the cliched way of the thinking outside the box, but I liked, there was a presentation that I saw on YouTube by Peg Luxick, who controls our children, and she talks about people being schooled into a confined way of thinking about things.
Right. So this is important to see that we are paying attention to how the other person is forming their decisions. That was the part of the logic scan, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if someone is sitting within the scarcity perspective model, they're operating from that perspective. It's either this or it's that. It's, or at the very least, it's limited numbers of options here. And there's an idea that they can deny that there's more options. This is very important to understand because that's where the person is coming from. So that's part of your analysis going on.
All right. That takes us to spheres of influence.
Ooh, I got this one from you, Brett. The spheres of influence, these, whether circles of influence, I think I heard you mention that long ago, and then I started to make it more three-dimensional. A metaphorically and subjectively measured series of influences of an individual upon other individuals, measured in concentric spheres of increasing distance from a person. Often, the further the sphere of influence is from the individual, the weaker the influence appears to be. For example, an individual's effect within one's family, the sphere of influence is usually considerably stronger than for an individual's effect amongst a wider population. So the effect that I have on you, Brett, since you're one of my colleagues, there's, you know, essentially a sphere of influence. You're within one of my spheres of influence. Mm-hmm. But someone who spends every day with me, they are really within my sphere of influence. And then, of course, there's someone like Barack Obama, really far away. The effects of our spheres of influence is almost homeopathic. It's really hard to measure. So the reason I put spheres of influence in this essay and the reason I'm covering it right now is so that we're paying attention to why we are doing something or what is the purpose of our conversation. So if we're speaking of something that's really far away and that we have no actual applicable action that's going to affect the situation we're discussing, it is academic. As long as we keep it in mind where the sphere is, it's really far out there, then we're in the realm of speculation almost. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter what conclusions we hold to, we can be flexible. But when it comes down to something really close to us, and we're likely going to be called upon to make a decision, and that's going to have a direct effect upon our actual lives, that's different. Then it's within a really close by sphere of influence. So this is a perspective to keep in mind when we're discussing specific topics.
Have you ever heard the metaphor of the seesaw when it comes to trying to bring about a large-scale change?
No, I'm sure.
I forget where I heard this, but it was just the other day. And it talks about, you know, the way things are as a seesaw where, you know, one end is down. Because somebody who said this could have been somebody I disagree with on almost everything, but this made a lot of sense. And there's just, you know, one heavy boulder that's holding down the end that you want to go up, you know, and the up end you want to come down. So we run around and we say, where are we going to find a big enough boulder? Where are we going to find a big enough boulder? And this seems to be, you know, analogous to people directing all of their attention to the outermost sphere of influence. You don't have the strength, you don't have the energy, you don't have the manpower to find that boulder and bring it back and then lift it onto this end of the seesaw that's up in the air. So this leads to resignation, this leads to disempowerment, this leads to frustration, this leads to all these negative and uncomfortable emotions. And in the metaphor, the person said, you know, they laughed at us as we went up to, you know, the other end of the seesaw with a tablespoon or a teaspoon of sand, one after the other. But then when the counterweight shifted the down end up, people said, how did that happen so fast? And what that means to me is when we're talking about things like the Federal Reserve or the military industrial complex, we are pitting ourselves against things that might involve everything from serious mental illness to backroom deals to central banks to the dark momentum of a long history of philosophic corruption, and we are avoiding the small places where we could be making small but valuable changes that eventually will bring about the large-scale change that we want to see.
Right. And when I covered in my first purposes, and when I covered why I made all of this work in the first place, why am I taking time out of my busy schedule to concoct these things, to go on various podcasts and to speak of these subjects? The purpose is because the greatest disharmony and problems that I see for all individuals, including myself, is interpersonally and close by within smaller and closer spheres of influence. Mm-hmm. And those wider ones that you mentioned, Brett, with the military-industrial complex, there's a wobble word for you.
These, right.
Yeah, I mean, these ideas out there, they're really far away. They're all consisting of individuals and their specific actions, basically. But in this case, those are people that I cannot name. I don't know who they specifically are. I can see some of the effects of their actions, but not all of them. That's really far and difficult to do. And it's true that I could whack away at it. I think this is often the whole Henry David Thoreau type quote of all of the people hacking away at the branches when it can just take one person going right to the root. And in this case, the root that I am trying to hack away at, the root is the interpersonal and internal disharmony. And there it is right there. That's something for everyone that I ever see. There is the big problem. Those bigger problems further out there, they're kind of almost like a metaphor for these smaller problems that are going on.
Indeed. You know, it reminds me, too, something that we talked about with getting things done. You know, a similar type of input, processing, and output method, the checklist, the magic motivating power and, you know, empowerment of making checklists instead of saying, oh, I got a project to do. You know, breaking a project into steps and next actions and checking them off as you go, dealing with smaller pieces is very encouraging and empowering to continue to move something very large forward or upward.
Right. And that other thing with the metaphor of the seesaw, the thing that came to mind when you were describing that metaphor was, hey, I've got an idea. Why don't I just go over here and set up a whole new seesaw? Or, hey, I've got another idea. Maybe I'm going to actually take some effort to try to push that boulder off of that side instead of trying to counteract it. Or, hey, you know, there's all these other and also ideas that started coming up in my mind. But you see, the scarcity model was automatically thinking the only way is if we all just go ahead and vote how many grains of sand we're going to put on the other side of the seesaw. You know, and if you're looking through that only model, that scarcity perspective, then, of course, you're going to have the type of effectiveness, I would say, in terms of the voting amidst a monopoly government style type situation, which we can see with most people. It's ineffective. You're not getting any results going on. And there comes to the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. This is part of the problem.
Absolutely. So the next two we've covered already, but as things are drawing to a close here, they are definitely both worth a recap. The first is Splinters of the Mind, a metaphor for the intellectual obstacles to forming objectively and empirically predictable results by virtue of using logical fallacies, or the empathetic obstacles to forming objectively and empirically predictable results, such as the choice to use the 4 D's of disconnected communication.
Yeah, I would add to that that traumatic conditioning, so that one has a stimulus and based upon previous trauma that was inflicted, an emotion and a pre-programmed response, that would be the consistent emotional situation. And so the splinters of the mind, splinters in the mind, it doesn't really matter. These are splinters, whether emotionally or purely intellectually, although there's always some type of emotional component seemingly going on. These are just situations that happen, and it was the awareness of such situations and the caring respect of such situations of other individuals that would seem to promote greater communication.
Yes, absolutely.
So the trivium method, which at this point I'm hoping everyone listening really knows, because you've spent the time going over Logic Saves Lives series and the series with Gene O'Denning, this is the use of grammar and logic and rhetoric. These are the qualitative arts. They compose the first three of the 7 liberal arts or liberating arts, and it corresponds to the computing idea of input, processing, output. The next 4 arts, which I am presently not highly learned in, but I continue to privately study on my own, are learned in the following sequence, and they complete the series of 7. They are known as the quadrivium. They are the quantitative arts, consisting of mathematics, or numbers in the abstract, geometry, or numbers in space, or 3 dimensions, music, which is numbers in time, or frequency, and astronomy, which is simultaneously numbers in space and time. I included them in here because I wanted to bridge the gap over to people who already are studying any one of those other 7 arts, basically. If you have spent some time on the trivium and you've heard of the quadrivium, I would encourage you to continue studying in that direction.
Yeah, a series on the quadrivium seems like a great challenge to me right now, but it's something that the more I learn about the trivium, the more excited I am about the prospect of doing that one day.
Yeah, I wanted to add about the quadrivium. The more I get into each little part of it to see the coincidences in our world, the way things are set up three-dimensionally, the coincidences numerically that seem to keep happening, the powers of frequency medicine, of which I am a practitioner of, how frequencies actually affect biological organisms. This is obviously established. And by the way, various military people are quite aware of this. That's why the active denial type of crowd dispersal technology of using certain acoustics or other microwave technologies to heat the first layer of skin on people and have people in a crowd disperse. Frequencies can be used to help or to hurt. So this is very important. And when we're taking in frequencies, such as when we're listening to music, the numbers in time, basically. This has an emotional effect on all of us, so we know this. So yeah, Brett, like you, I'm excited at each of the prospects of these things. I cannot deny the effect of the quantitative arts, but I have to say that it's very effective to first study the trivium. It helps you understand the quadrivium, in my opinion.
Absolutely, absolutely. The last one on our list for today is, what's alive in you? This is an NVC phrase that roughly translates to, what are you feeling right now? And what are the internal motivating factors that are seemingly creating those feelings?
Yep, this was a statement coming from Marshall Rosenberg a while ago. It's something that I use when I'm hanging out on Google Plus with my NVC friends and we're discussing these topics, making that statement as an opening so that someone can actually unzip that part of themselves to say, yeah, I've got these pressures on me right now. I'm feeling these anxieties. It's all of these things are going on. And hopefully the person might or might not mention what motivates them. But in case they don't, the other people are there to hold space for them and also to point out, hey, you have a need for this or that, such as ease and efficiency or accomplishment of sorts. And these are ways basically of connecting with people. It's just a phrase. It was the W, the final question there. Mm-hmm. And what's alive in you is very important. It's a good place to end on, basically, because this is the grammar. This is the grammar of all of this information. We covered the A through Z of topics that I prepared for this.
Mm-hmm. So from there, in upcoming shows, we will move into the logic of this method. And I hope that people have taken some notes. I think it'll be okay for us, Daryl, to include this glossary in show notes.
Exactly, yes.
So if at this point you say, oh no, I haven't taken any notes, it will be available somewhere. And hopefully in this introductory installment of this series, we've created something that people can reference back to if at any point in upcoming shows they feel lost or confused. Because again, this is a new language and it is a lot to process in a short amount of time. But I think it is a very, very important pursuit. And I certainly look forward to whatever feedback comes our way on this series.
Thanks for all of this, Brett.
My pleasure. Thank you, sir. That was fantastic. I feel so much better about this now, just dealing with this part first.
Excellent.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, because we got this out of the way, as well as also it adds clarity, right? It's kind of, this is the way I teach information, and I find it sticks with the students. Because we start with this big, bad glossary of brand new terms, Oriental medically speaking. And for someone who's coming from, say, Western diagnosis and a Western language, that's a problem because it's a whole new language. And in the same way, if we've been trained to not think, if we have previously received training to not understand what motivates us, to not actually even have a word for our feelings, that's a problem. So to remove that obstacle and see it as an opportunity, that's what I'm looking to do.
Gene was telling me his story, and by now the people listening will have heard this story, when he first started his preceptorship in, I want to call it dental engineering. The mentor that he had instructed him to copy things out of the dictionary, which
right.
might seem incredibly repetitive and tedious, but the dividends that it pays in the long run are obviously significant. And I think we've made this much more entertaining than copying things out of the dictionary today.
I think so, because to some extent, I've had to come up with brand new grammar in order to convey some of the ideas. Luckily, though, I didn't have to come up with absolutely completely brand new words. I just had to put a few together in certain sequences. And I also have been finding this way with teaching. I've been finding that it's the action, the doing part, remember when you were going over the methods of learning, it's in the act of actually moving one's hand over to write the words out that actual information starts to become more active. Reading it is considerably less. Listening to it is a little bit more useful auditorily.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking it, moving your mouth, such as I'm doing, to read things out loud over and over again, like a narrator, like some expert vocal talent, basically, that is a procedure, and it's in the action there becomes more actual learning that seems to happen.
I agree. From my experience, I certainly agree. So we are going to leave it there. Daryl, thanks again so much, and we will resume with this shortly.
Thank you, Brett. The moral of this story.